Hello,
can you hear me?
Have we hit a bit of hang up with our Mr. Copeland,
right,
who is Mr. Swain?
That's right. That will make it difficult for him to hear the same
thing. It is. So, he's sort of on standby trying to find out when the best time for him to slot in the next 2 days is. So, I thought I would just get that discussion with you first.
Friday afternoon.
Friday afternoon?
Yes.
Yep.
We've got ourselves finishing at 4:10.
Yeah.
I suspect it'll be earlier than that.
Yeah. Okay.
I was hoping for an early departure.
Friday morning.
Okay. 10 o'clock.
Yep. Sorry. now separated into an area FA and FB, and we went and visited that area and walked most of the boundary outline and identified where the O&L boundary is in relation to that. And that's also shown on the attached map, the O&L boundary. That's shown as the blue thing dashed line.
Yes.
And so Dr. Reed and I agreed that there is development potential within the area FB to the north, which is on the next, on the plan. That is falls within the O&L line as it is identified in the district plan, but it has development potential. So we recorded that in our statement. And we agreed that a density of 2 dwellings per hectare would be appropriate for area FB, and that also applies to area G, so that was one of our agreements. And then we looked at area FA, where there was a slight difference in opinion on that. So while we put forward a density that would be the same as for area D, Dr. Reed considered that while the density could be higher than for FD, it shouldn't be quite as high as for D, so she considers that as a transitional area between the two. I still think it would be appropriate to have the same density as for D, because if it's based on the landform, which I did in my evidence, it's also very similar to D, and you would get the village in order, you know, that residential area at hard edge by doing that, and you can't actually see the difference because it's flat, so you would, in order to overlook the area, you have to be on an elevated point, otherwise you wouldn't actually see the difference in density. So that was the rationale for promoting the same density as for D. However, you know, I can also see her rationale. I think you can argue either one, to be honest, and we're not very far apart. So what she felt comfortable with was a density of 10 to 15 dwellings per hectare. And so her upper density would be very close to my lower one anyway. So I mean, I'd be just as happy to go with 10 to 15.
So that comes down to essentially whether you have a transition or a...
That's right, if you want to set up an edge or if you want to have a hard line based on the landform.
Yes.
And I think either one can be argued, to be honest.
that's something that we have to deal with, actually, not only in this location but throughout the district.
Yes.
Can I just ask this for clarification there? The FB and the G, effectively the district,
that'd
be the same. There could be one
site.
There could be one activity area.
Yes. Yeah.
The other question I had is, I take it from the last line of that first paragraph under the heading areas RHBS and G, that between the two of you felt that the O&L line was not as drawn as a result of the environment course hearing could actually be shifted to the zone boundary. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, yeah. So in terms of the history of the line, it's been drawn on a topographical map with quite a bit. And so once you actually go out and analyze it, and we had, you know, a GPS with a map in our hands and walked the line together. And we both felt that the O&L boundary should actually align with the northern boundary of FB.
Yes.
And so...
Now, did you have the opportunity, or will you have the opportunity, to do the same for where it joins this area down here, where it's the O&L line sort of flows through there, but the zone boundary seems to be over
150
to 200
metres
away.
I think, I mean, I wouldn't want to commit
Dr.
Reed to deciding this without looking at
it. No, I was meaning, would the pair of you have the opportunity to do that?
I can talk to her about it.
Yeah, I mean, it would be helpful for us, because I think that from what I understand, there's an agreement that where it is actually outstanding natural landscape, we need to treat it as such.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to know where the edge actually is agreed to between the landscape architects, I think, rather than in this case, that seems incongruous with the location. It runs through the middle of two home sites, and there's two virtually entirely within the O&L. It may be that it's a slightly different location when you get on the site.
Yeah, I certainly did talk to her about it when we were at home site 37, not yesterday, but a few weeks back.
Yes.
And I think she may agree that the boundary should be but
yeah.
I can ask her and she might say she thinks it should be where it is, and then
perhaps now that I've got close counsel in the room, and Scott, I'm pretty sure this, if we could possibly have both landscape architects look at the potential of a joint witness statement on that line as well, it would be helpful. And if there's disagreement, that's fine, but if there can be agreement, that would assist us.
When would you require that?
Certainly by the end of next week.
I'll see if we can do this.
Yeah, I'll certainly reiterate that because there's a distinct discomfort about three or six house sites. Now, I know there's a debate about the other two, and certainly I'll be in the two area, but that's a bit concerning.
Mm. I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, we understand that the scale that it was originally determined is, you know, wasn't finessed, if you like.
Yeah. It wasn't done on the site.
No.
Okay, I'll contact the staff and then see if she has a bit.
Thank you, that would be very helpful.
Corrections. So I have two corrections. The first one relates to what's now the area, residential area of Highway 3. So if you could please turn to paragraph 80, my evidence. So between paragraphs 80 and 86, I make in several instances references to the spatial layout plan and the comprehensive development plan. That was an oversight. That was proposed as part of the area E part. Right. While I was supposed to mix between education and residential, it was the intention to prepare this plan. When it then changed to solely residential, the need for that plan was eliminated. So it is still in there that there would be a comprehensive development plan developed, but that is not the case anymore.
Okay, so we can take the broad change, your correction is that you're not supporting or suggesting that that is needed.
That's correct, yeah. And that's what I've several references throughout these six or seven paragraphs that need to be deleted. And then the other correction was in paragraph 61. And there I made the reference in the last sentence stating that it is proposed to make development within the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area and the Lateral Protection Area non-compliant. That's incorrect, so it only applies to the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area, whereas it would be discretionary in the Lateral Protection Area. That was all of my corrections. So I'm going to turn to the summary. My name is Yvonne Kruger. I'm a qualified landscape architect with over 13 years experience and good knowledge of the Queensland landscape in general and the checkpoint area specifically. also provide a landscape evidence on behalf of Derby Partners on changes we've worked in 2015. I prepared a joint business statement with Dr. Lee on the 14th of February, which I'll refer to in a summary. The key features of the amended checkpoint structure plan and provisions for the JPZ that I covered in the evidence can be summarised as follows. Notified residential area, State Highway 1 and 2. Addition of new areas of residential development near State Highway 6 to provide opportunities for low density living opportunities with appropriate mitigation of visual impacts on State Highway 6. The visual effect of the proposed development areas from the highway will be effectively managed through screening in the form of mitigation planting and mounding, so that they will not be readily visible. The design outcomes will be similar to the existing checkpoint areas close to the highway, which form part of the existing environment. Proposed Rule 41.1.1 will ensure an appropriate design quality and implementation of the screening. Notified residential areas F and G. In those areas, the proposal has been modified in response to the recommendations of the recent landscape evidence. He has subsequently reached agreement on these areas based on our joint on-site findings as outlined in our witness statement. Area F has been split into two sub-areas. Within the sub-areas, it is proposed to provide for higher-density residential areas within FA, similar to D, and a lower-density development within area FB, with much larger lot sizes. This approach takes into account that the lower flat slopes within FA are perceived as part of the adjacent residential area within Hendydowns, whereas the topography is more complex within FB, and existing native vegetation needs to be considered. Further refinements were undertaken in SB since the preparation of my evidence, and they are covered in the joint witness statement. Within area G, lower densities are proposed throughout the whole area. It is intended to set houses sensitively amongst the complex topography and gullies, with a similar approach for G and SB for building platforms identified at time of subdivision. The 22 preserved pond sites. Identification of pond sites in specifically selected areas to provide rural living on the eastern tablelands and management of open space around Peninsula Hill. In the former SD1 activity area, 20 pond sites will be located within the open space gulf area. The proposed density is similar to the existing tableland pond sites and allows individual location of buildings on suitable building sites. Conservation benefits can be realised through native revegetation. I consider all proposed home sites appropriate apart from home sites 46, 51, 52 and 53, where alternative locations were agreed with Dr. Reed. Within the former SP2 activity area, only two preserved home sites would be located surrounded by large areas of open space landscape with farming activities. The proposed preserve pond sites 57 and 58 are located in folds off the rising slopes of Peninsula Hill in pockets of enclosed hummock terrain that could facilitate development. All building development outside the home sites and the Peninsula Hill landscape protection area is discretionary activity. Within the landscape protection area, all building development is a non-compliant activity. In my view, this high level of protection in combination with a high degree of certainty regarding potential building locations is an appropriate landscape outcome for Peninsula Hill and the wider landscape. Just to clarify that the building development rules in respect of farming activities in recreation activities, those are the control protections.
I'll discuss that.
Okay. Cool. So just to be clear that residential activity area, Hendydowns Highway 3. Instead of the notified education innovation campus, an activity area is now proposed that allows for residential use. The effectiveness of screening of views from the highway will be ensured through a proposed new rule. The currently proposed scale of built form within the residential area will be less than originally proposed within the EIC in terms of height and site coverage. I concur with Dr. Reed that development of this area in accordance with the proposed regime would not have any more significant effects on the landscape or visual amenity than the EIC and would possibly have lesser effects. Text point village activity area. The deletion of the notified education precinct area and incorporation of the area and surrounds into the text point village activity area would, in my view, lead to low effects in terms of landscape character and amenity in the context of the existing village and future construction of the mixed use and visitor accommodation areas. I consider that the nature of the effect is likely to be perceived as neutral rather than adverse by the surrounding community. I understand the village could also include educational uses. The visibility of the area is limited to the dwellings along the west-facing escarpment edges of the southern part of the existing checkpoint residential area. Views from a short stretch of State Highway 6 at long distances would be inconsequential in my opinion. It has to be taken into account that checkpoint is undergoing a transformational change through the establishment of the village core, which this area would be a logical extension to. Watershed Access Road. An additional access road along the existing Watershed Road will ensure that the residential amenity within Jacks Point and Southern Henley Downs will not be affected from through traffic. The visual effects from this additional entrance of State Highway 6 will be localised and, in my opinion, not adverse. Conclusion. In my view, the proposed design and opportunities for council control will ensure that adverse visual amenity effects can be avoided on neighbouring properties, submitters, owners and occupants of Jacks Point properties and users of State Highway 6 and Lake Hawkins.
Now, in terms of the treatment of the state highway residential subzones, I think at one stage, earlier on, Dr. Reed's evidence was suggesting a 75 metre setback. So in your discussions that you've been having with her, where has that got to at the moment? Is that still part of the mix, or is it simply a part of the requirement?
No, we didn't discuss it further, no. The existing buffer that's shown on the map is about 35 metres,
yeah.
And so that would be an additional 40 metres or so where, so the mitigation is proposed at that distance, and so that's an additional 40 metres where that would be applied, as she suggests. I don't think that would be required in the context of implementing the
mitigation. So you say not as a rule, but rather in practice required by establishing mounting, such like you would.
Yeah, but I think by establishing that mitigation, you then don't need to have the discretionary activity in addition to the screening. So by having that as a controlled activity to implement the screening that's appropriate, in my view, that's sufficient to then implement the zone behind it without having a discretionary, additional discretionary activity status in those areas.
Okay. In terms of, is it intended that that makes development invisible or just simply only fleeting glass?
I think it is worded at the moment reasonably difficult to see or something like that. So it's there already, as you drive along there, houses are visible, but they're not visually prominent. So if you try to see houses, you'll be able to see houses. I think that will still be the case, but they're not visually prominent, but they would attract the viewer's eye as they travel along the highway.
Right, okay. Now, in the residential A, D, F, B and G, you're talking here about a minimum area of 2 hectares. Is that a minimum or like an average minimum? Or? I presume it's a minimum area of 2 hectares for
quite a size.
Talking here about residential HDFB and residential HDG. I'm looking at your paragraph 4.
So that's 2 dwellings per hectare.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, 2 dwellings per hectare, which is about 5,000 square metres.
So that would be form, there would be a rule to that effect in the subdivision chapter 27, right?
I assume so.
FB
and G are the density
we proposed
to
dwellings
protected.
FB
agreed
in there and
I agreed yesterday.
Yes. Okay. All right, and in terms of dwellings built on those lots, what, in terms of discussion with Dr. Reed, what was the impact to Reed's agreement, what would be the activity status?
So, the actual building, so there was a time of subdivision, as a controlled activity building platforms would be identified.
Sure.
And also to identify areas of revegetation. I think that's actually in our
joint statement as well. Okay. Now, in paragraph 7, we're talking here about the Jack's Point village area and the possible extension to include the area in. Now, in terms of the potential visual impacts of that, if it's education activities, or even possibly healthcare activities, you're generally going to get potentially large buildings, but they'll be surrounded by a lot of open space. Clients have sought for retail and commercial activities, would that have a rather different visual impact in the sense that you would have much higher density of buildings and associated car parking that would produce a different outlook? So if you're in one of those Jack's Point residential areas and you're looking out over it, if it would allow a greater range of commercial activities, would that have a greater adverse visual effect?
Well, I think for health it might be quite similar, because you probably anticipate a bit of car parking associated as well, but if you had playing fields associated with the school, that would be different, but in the context of the view that you already get, if you're looking out towards that way, you already will see the remainder of the village as well. So, yes, it would be different, but so what I said is that I don't think the effects are adverse, but I think in terms of the scale of the effects, I don't think that's an adverse effect. It would be different, but I don't think it's adverse. That, in my view, would be perceived as a logical extension to what's already here next to the before. And it's quite a limited number of houses that look out that way, because it's mainly along the
criteria setting out what are appropriate locations for such building platforms?
Well, it could have met some things that are relevant in my view is the existing vegetation, plant vegetation, because there's not so much in G, but in area F B there's some mature muscari, which would be quite good to me. And something I discussed with Dr. Lee yesterday was about some rocky outcrops, and so it's about maintaining the integrity of the
We had control reserved over the building platforms based on management. Land reform and minimising disturbance of native vegetation.
I'm just worried about the application of something that's too general. And land form could just mean. That's what I was questioning. I mean, you said here the existing vegetation is important, so that seems to be picked up. But it's the rocky outcrops rather than. Are we trying to hide these behind mounds? Or?
No, not necessarily. You'll probably see when you're at the site, it's quite a set platform. Mm-hmm. And so there are some very flat sites there that I could find by rocky ridges. And so I wouldn't anticipate that you need to do a lot of mounding and that. So there's some quite logical kind of spots. It'd be quite hard to site it on the rocky
right.
Anyway.
Yes.
That could be it.
Is it that you're looking to minimise the approach to create building platforms? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's more about maintaining the rocky outcrop,
right.
Because they really create that character of the top area.
To the area, which is outstanding natural landscape at Gates Point, should be treated the same as outstanding natural landscape at what we're zoned rural.
I think it's a sensitive landscape. I actually consider that the slopes, the quite visible slopes, they are the visually sensitive parts. And so, I mean, you've got two options, and I think with the package that we put forward in the end, you get a much higher degree of certainty around the protection of the visually sensitive parts of the peninsula hill landscape. But I think it's interesting that on the northern side, the ONL actually follows zone boundaries, and they're not all implemented. So.
Yes.
Where it comes quite close to home size 58, which is the top one. There's a low density, I think it's, residential area that comes quite close from the northwestern side to it. And there the ONL actually excludes that, even though on the ground you can't see any of that at the moment. So
there's a few instances,
yeah.
I think the zone was already in place.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's interesting that that's not the case for Jack's Point, but that the ONL actually automates Jack's Point zone.
From what you said, I understand what you're saying. I'm just wondering now if you put that in context with farm buildings, which in the rural area, while they're permitted at a very low intensity, the farm has to be 100 hectares. Things such as that. And as I understand it, the rules that are proposed are suggesting that farm buildings can go anywhere in the area now, on Jack's Point, as a controlled activity.
It would be less permitted than in the rural area.
There's no limit on coming in.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm.
And the same as recreation buildings. I'm just wondering if your view on perhaps how many you think would be appropriate.
Probably depends how it expands.
I don't think it would be a zero fund.
No. I hope not. From a landscape perspective, it would be preferable to have these buildings within the folds as well, rather than having them on the open slopes.
Okay.
And to be fair, the folds, you can absorb quite a lot of them, but
thank you very much.
Appropriately. the RHD if areas should be separated into two subzones, if A and if B, to better reflect the underlying landform, and more site-specific criteria should be provided for potential home sites within if B. The subzones will enable a more appropriate level of integration between adjoining high medium density development and low density development areas. The RHDG area should be developed at a density and site size equivalent to RHDFB. And the existing RJP2A area could be retained without change. There has been significant growth and development since the original Coondoon Area Resource Study was commissioned. In light of these changes, and having undertaken a more fine-grained analysis and update study, I consider that the proposal put forward by the Jacks Point entities in this area will provide for a comprehensive and appropriate land use and landscape management strategy for the completion of the Jacks Point zone. I consider proposed amendments to the previous FP1 and FP2 activity areas will ensure development preserves the existing landscape character, in particular the specific and careful siting of home sites will ensure development occurs in those areas of the landscape capable of absorbing such development. Details of further controls included in paragraphs 27 and 28 of my program notes will provide additional controls on residential buildings within the home site areas. Amendments proposed to relocate HS51, HS52 and HS53 to alternative sites identified through the joint witness statement, which is the statement which I was referring to earlier, should now adequately address concerns around site containment as outlined in Dr. Reed's summary of evidence. HS57 and HS58 have been sited specifically within two pockets that have potential to absorb some limited low-density development as they occur in areas of low visibility and are in accordance with the Coondoon Area Resource Study. To address any concerns regarding HS57 and HS58 raised by Dr. Reed in his summary of evidence, I suggest that matters for assessment could be restricted to infrastructure, earthworks, access and parking, open location and lighting. This would still enable council to maintain an appropriate level of control. Through my own observations, I support that the lower portions of RHDFA could potentially absorb a higher density development due to the area having similar landscape character to the adjacent RHDD activity area and at a density of 17 to 26 per GTF. I also support that the upper portion of previous RHDF could be developed at a lower density than originally proposed, as this landform is more sensitive to development. The upper portion of RHDFB is a far more complex landform when compared to the lower portions, exhibiting more undulating landform character with large areas of open grassland interspersed with grey shrubland and rocky features. This area is approximately 6.77 hectares in size and could absorb a density of 2 per hectare, yielding some 10 to 12 sites. In the RHDG activity area, a similar home site approach is proposed by RHDFB would enable a similar low density development between adjoining areas along the lower slopes. This area is approximately 4.65 hectares in size and could absorb a density of 2 per hectare, yielding some 8 to 10 sites. The notified structured land sought to expand RJP2A further west by approximately 0.8 hectares. It is my view that a change to the western boundary of this activity area is not necessary. I also attach an updated structure plan with yesterday's date and note the following updates relevant to my evidence. The first being addition of the tablelands area as an overlay on the structure plan. Identification of HS51A, HS52A and HS53A to replace previous HS51, HS52 and HS53. A correction to the key from a structure plan to include an open space patch pattern. And a correction of the RHDV boundary.
On that very last point, is that a correction of the boundary? Corrected from what?
I think Mr. Coburn referred to that area at his evidence as the spur land, am I correct?
Yes, I know the piece of land you're talking about.
So on the structure plan, that has just now been corrected to exclude the spur land.
So what you're saying is the notified version is incorrect?
Correct.
No.
Probably
use the word amendment. Yes, I suppose it was a correction if I was.
Yeah.
I just clarifying that.
Yeah.
Just a couple of brief things. The correction of the key on the structure plan where we've got that hatching, so I showed it up more clearly. Is there any particular reason why that couldn't just be shown as open space A zone? Scale of the plan is a problem. So that's effectively what it's going to be, isn't it? It's going to be OSA.
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
That might be because of the relationship to the rules and how it's referred to, so I just wonder if Mr. Ferguson might be able to tie that language in.
Yeah, that would be well. Yeah, if you think about that, I'm assuming that for purposes of rules, the rules would be the same as OSA, that's what I understood.
No, I wouldn't assume that, so Mr. Ferguson can clarify whether or not that assumption is correct.
I assume too much.
You may assume too much.
All right, fair enough.
Are you anticipating that access to them will be covered sufficiently with matters of assessment maintenance or something?
I'm sorry.
How access to them, how would you anticipate that being over and where else? Is that going to be contained within matters of assessment and restricted to earthworks access department?
In a sense, yes. When you're on site, access to HS57 and 58 really can only be from one location. That is through the little holes and gullies of the Mitchell Hill. Dr. Reed raised concerns about access potentially traversing the Mitchell Hill landscape protection area. And I think I looked at that in my original evidence. And I agreed with her that that is probably inappropriate. And during our discussions, we kind of came to the conclusion that the gully was the only viable access option. There are currently existing farm tracks through those gullies, and they would probably be a starting point for trying to work out the most appropriate one.
Just one question, and just a matter of clarification. In paragraph 27, the you say in the open space one, a minimum of 3,000 square meters or 20%. Which is less or greater? It's unfair.
Yeah, you're right. It is the greater of.
It's the greater of. Right. Thanks very much. It's a pass.
Thank you. While we're on the topic, Mr. Ferguson's looked at the rules in respect of the open space hatch. Tell us what the answer is.
That's part of the structure plan called 41.3. And in fact, it's down in the open space area that's shown by the construction plan is through the in and out through the choice area. So, probably the key difference, just generally speaking, is your plan of the design of that area is this emerging area of the activity areas that are supposed to be collection behind. And so the approach to that area is to take an overlay, which is the open space, and then come over the top. I think what is, with the creek, you know, if I stand for it, that that's not the creek, but I'm pretty sure that's Washington Creek. And so the overlay comes on top of that through the structure plan role. It requires open space to be shown and created at the top of subdivision. And it's a program for how they can do so.
So what you're saying is it's a water course that's really big enough to justify an estimate of reserve, but it's a rule which gives some form of estimate protection. Is it essentially?
No, I don't. Can't ask the question about the implication of this reserve.
Well, I said,
would provide a similar function.
That's what I mean.
Yes,
it's
similar function.
So it's a rule framework stronger, assuming it was a property developer, if I want to provide a setback along that. So it's definitely strong enough to be able to enable the council to say, well, that cannot be built on the development on, whatever the case may be. I would imagine it would probably be good to have some form of public access up and down there.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a strong framework of the rule. The approach obviously the open space is kind of different. And the detail material is actually identified as an open space activity area. This form of open space is the overlay, and it says in the rule that the open space is shown indicatively in its application of the grant that has been established in the subdivision process. So development prior to the subdivision, which would preclude the creation of the open space should continue to be contrary to the rule. And then when you go to do the subdivision, you then create the open space as and where necessary as how I can in the rule.
Yeah. The reason I keep raising this, it was originally raised in the initial evidence of Dr. Reed, who said, well, just make a continuation of the OSA linkage, that's how this question came about.
I'm curious. Mr. Wright has got a couple of minor corrections to his evidence and chief as well. If you can get that handy.
Thank you.
Potential in any of the areas?
Yes, the framework for the fuel efficiency standards provided, provided in the subsequent application, and the zones and hazmats clearly identify the location, fans. It does not cover things like slope stability as a general rule, because that is very much a soft-specific area and consideration, and should be addressed by the geotechnical, within the geotechnical investigation report for any particular application.
Right. So there could be one or two areas within the Jack's point where the southern potential is not something to be able to expect.
There are areas there already which don't have easy building areas. However, as engineers, what do I do? We can build anything to do
I've understood that. That's been telling me Davis since we came on time. Okay, thank you very much.
As you all recall, and a memorandum that I lodged the company the day of, Mr. Gourmet is out of the country this week. So he is available to ask questions in writing because he's in Canada with his family. So if there are questions for Mr. Gourmet, they can be responded to in the appropriate time. We have prepared a two-page summary. Not that he's going to bring it out, but just in case that would be helpful to jog the memory in terms of what the evidence has yet covered.
Questions looks like you find it useful. I have no questions.
Just have a quick look at the summary.
Yes,
some stars, but the summary can't answer.
There has been a situation in the past, I've involved one personally, where the courts have held us that all you're really looking at is a planning opportunity, so all we should concern ourselves with is that in planning terms, would it be suitable, would the site be suitable for a school in this instance? Now the fact that the landowner may or may not agree to allowing that to be built on their land is immaterial. So in other words, all we really need to look at is whether or not the activity is appropriate or not. Now, I'm wondering what your view on that is, because it's originally when Clearwater and Christchurch was developed,
yeah.
Regional Council said over our dead body. Yeah. Well, it happened. They got into discussions and then they agreed that it would be okay.
Yeah.
So that, I'm just wondering what comment you might have on that. Should we be considering the owner's agreement as a relevant factor at all?
Well, the fact that the land is currently used for and an integral part of the infrastructure of the zone and servicing a certain neighbourhood in terms of wastewater treatment, one of the matters you've got to take into account is the sustainable management of physical resources and infrastructure as a physical resource. And so to create a planning opportunity that disregards ongoing use of that sunk equally into that resource and the need for obviously wastewater to be disposed of doesn't give appropriate weight in that respect to the existing use of the land. So there's that matter that you still have to take into account as well. And then from memory, but I have to go back and find references. I think there were also concerns expressed by residents in terms of the effect on the open space values of that area and the impacts that buildings would have on those current energy values.
Okay. Just in that, would do the regional council consents require the use of that land?
Yes, they are site specific.
Would that be a relevant consideration?
Well, that's right, they would require variation if they were to be if it was to be discharged in a different place. That would require a variation of those consents. And I think we can get copies of those consents if it's relevant. There is a restriction on the use of the land associated with the implementation of those consents. There's a corresponding restriction on what else that land can be used for. So if that level of detail is helpful, we can get into those.
I think it might be useful to have a regional council consent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'll make sure we get those to you by Friday when we come back with those instructions. It's also most likely, and again I'll clarify this, be classified as a hail site.
Well, yes, but it would automatically trigger when it's a wastewater.
So that triggers, it will automatically trigger a new condition requirement if the change, if there is a land use change to that site under the NES.
And schools fall into the sense of the category.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. We are ready for Mr. Ferguson.
Can I ask that the microphone be put quite close to you, but you speak as softly as I do? And I've got mine right up here.
That's a good conversation for you.
Yes.
Well, I don't have any questions to make from the main statement, but I'll just take this in my summary, if that's okay.
Yes, good to know.
Well, you're doing some preaching to make on that already. So let's see. In paragraph one, of what an associate principal, what principal is that? Principal? I have stated in paragraph 23, in the second sentence, about the density of rural trees, and I include the lot size. So can I just please strike out the words or lot size?
Sorry, where is it?
Second sentence of paragraph 23.
starts, we are either an entity, strike out all lots of us. Well, I suppose it's either probably the exhibition or two. Change from activity status, strike out the words from control. The effect of what I'm saying, if I can explain it, for what it is that we're not undertaking what we're acknowledging that there is a lot size need to get down to get the density that's proposed. But what I've done in my viewing process is I've done it entirely on density. So it's conservative in terms of the estimation.
So just in that same sentence, should it read rules trigger change of activity status rather than from activity status?
Yes.
It is.
And at paragraph 25, in the second to last line, I think it would be referred to OSA in respect of the proposed open space community recreation area. I think I believe that's meant to be OSB outline.
Yeah, that's
all the correction I need to make. I'd like to start at paragraph 3.
Cool.
My statement of evidence dated 3rd February 2017 provides a summary of the background information to project on its own, including its relationship with the National Policy Statement on Development Capacity, the Otago Regional Policy Statements, and the higher order strategic directions of the policy statement for the plan. The key changes recommended through my evidence include the removal of the FD1 and FD2 areas and the identification of 22 home sites, together with the remainder of the area reverting to OSG or OSL and associated promotions to the landscape. Alterations to the E2 rule applying to a number of residential activity areas to correct inaccuracies and recognise improved development densities. Provision for a third approved access to SNOR-OS6 and the removal of the threshold. Consolidation of the Jackson Point Village area across the main identified for education activities, together with the new comprehensive development plan, requirement and associated policies to ensure good design outcomes. Replacement of the EYC area with the residential activity area to be developed in the same way as the Part HDSH1 activity area as a residential activity area. Adjustments to the boundaries of some residential activity areas to recognise improved development. An additional rule to link subdivision to residential building platforms. The relocation of the acoustic insulation rule into the Jackson Zone chapter as anticipated for the original chapter 26. The expert evidence submitted in relation to this topic continues to inform and refine the issues addressed in my evidence. I have taken the opportunity through this statement to update the commissioners on matters raised through the evidence of other parties, including suggested changes to the plan provisions. My suggested updates to Chapter 41, the Jackson Point Zone provisions are contained in Appendix 1, with the changes proposed to Chapter 27, which is subsequently contained in Appendix 2. I don't propose to dive straight into those attachments straight away, other than to note that they are an update of the version that's given by the evidence, for which I've highlighted those changes in yellow. So we've got a little bit of a different so. State highway access, the evidence of Mr. McColl for the NZ Transport Agency refers to whether the Woolshed Road intersection will be upgraded, what its function will be, and what areas that may serve and that might occur. Mr. McColl notes that if the proposed provisions are approved and the development potential increases, then Mr. McColl considers it is likely that an additional access
to the subject site through Horsham Road will be required in the future. Mr. McColl suggests further that then the traffic will then be undertaken to turn out a new traffic, or that the traffic effects become a matter of discretion or control when considering development within the zone so that the Horsham Road satellites at the intersection can be required to be upgraded when necessary. Given there is not at this time a traffic model, I am focused on the alternative suggestion to develop further measures of control or discretion that could be more appropriately used to manage the effects of state highway of traffic using Bullshit Road on the state highway network. In terms of the planning context for a consideration of this approach, which generally provides for residential activity within the main residential activity areas as permitted, and a small number of other non-residential activities subject to consent within the zone as a controlled or restricted discretionary activity. A much broader range of activities, including those falling outside of the prescribed activities within the structure plan form, are fully discretionary or not. All subdivision is proposed to be controlled within the Jackpot zone, and meaning it has the added advantage of capturing the precursor to residential activity, which would be otherwise permitted. So based on this, I propose the insertion of new maps of control or discretion to the following rules that are likely to create traffic generation outside of the zone, and the cumulative effect of which in the state highway could be assessed at the time of consent. Chapter 41, the first of those rules relates to education and daycare facilities, which are obviously rule 41.471 relating to medium density residential development, which is also listed as a control activity. Rule 41.491 which lists commercial and community activities located within the RHC and the RHC SH activities as a restricted discretionary activity. And Rule 41.581 related to density, which again is also restricted discretionary. Within the subdivision chapter, Rule 27.74 from the revised proposal, matters of control subdivision within the Jackpot zone, and Rule 27.712.3 subdivision within the heavy bounce parts of the Jackpot zone. I suggest wording for the proposed matter of control to be applied to each of the rules as follows. Within the RHC and RHC SH activity areas of the Jackpot zone, control should include effects on the safety and efficiency of the state highway switch road network at any intersections with the Jackpot zone until such time as the new intersection and upgraded Bullshit Road has been completed and is available for use. The wording is designed to apply to the residential Henry Downs and the residential Henry Downs state highway areas, being considered the most likely to access Horsham Road over the existing RHX Road, the main effects being on the safe and efficient function of the state highway network as it interfaces with the Jack's Point zone, and finally its application ceases once the upgrade of Horsham Road has been complete. Expansion of the village to include activity area E. My statement of evidence dated 3 February 2017 supports consolidation of the commercial activity within the expanded village area of 26.8 hectares. The council's latest position set out in the statement summary evidence from Vicky Jones dated 13 February 2017 supports an extension to the notified education activity area E adjacent to the Jacksport village, but retaining as a specific index of the area rather than absorbing that into the enlarged village. In a footnote reference, Ms. Jones reiterates the reasons outlined in the original Section 42A report, and adds reasons relating to landscape effects, efficiency, and certainty of outcome. This outcome will result in the potential aggregation of activity adjacent to the village and close to the village core. As a separate activity area, it would not however gain the benefit of being included within the overall village comprehensive development and thus derive to the same extent possible under the expanded village the integration of built open spaces and transportation connections. If Ms. Jones is concerned that expansion of the village activity area has the potential to shut out the potential for the development of the school for Jack's project, this could be addressed in other ways. In particular, the proposed comprehensive development could be amended to include, as a matter of control, that plan make the provision for not less than 2 hectares aggregate security of land for a school for local residents. I refer to the evidence of Ms. Flew, who at paragraph 78 finds that the extension of the Jackson Village to the south would lead to no effects in terms of landscape character and density, with the nature of the effect likely to be perceived as neutral rather than adverse by the surrounding community. The scale of conversion activity. An issue that I have become aware of through discussions with Mr. Heath at the commencement of this hearing on the subject of the limitations on total commercial activity is with his reference to commercial services and the operation of the proposed scale of the commercial activity rule. The revised rule 4159 contained within section 42A report applies restrictions to commercial activities in terms of both any single commercial activity and aggregated cap. I note that the evidence of Mr. Heck relies on the definition of commercial services that would include activities such as dry cleaners, estate agents, doctors, accountants, business services, etc. The proposed district plan does not include a single definition of commercial services, and the wording of the rule instead relies on the definition of commercial activities, which I'll discuss below. But I'm reading out your mind, but it's
not what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, the point of this is bigger than scope than commercial service. So doing so in reliance on the commercial activity definition, that's inadvertently capturing a broader range of activities not intended to be subject to the overall cap on retail and commercial services, suggested by that such as restaurants, professional, commercial and administrative offices. So in addition, Mr. Heath also factors provision within the analysis of the supermarket, which he acknowledges would breach the 200 square metre individual terms of care. So given these points, the limitation that the proposed district plan does not contain a separate definition of commercial services, and the evidence of Mr. Copeland supporting commercial activity without care, an alternative to capping individual commercial activity penalties as it's defined to 200 square metres would be to instead cap retail activity, which could exclude the establishment of a simple supermarket. Density and lots of others. In paragraph 50, the evidence of pistol bottles reproduces a part of the density table from 44 times 581, with average lot sizes included to demonstrate how in some parts of the inner house it would be difficult to achieve the required density range without creating small lots. I note that the average lot sizes included within the table of Mr. Wilson's evidence are not what would result in compliance with the density table. And this is because the lot sizes included within the table of Mr. Wells are based on gross areas, with the rule itself relating to net density, which would exclude reserves, roads, and open space. So what I've done is calculate the lot size that would result from compliance with the net density calculation. And in doing so, I've just assumed a standard reduction of 30% for open space, roads, reserves, etc. I've done that on the table below. The table's the same except for the right-hand two columns. So based on this table, the maximum net density within the activity areas RHC and A to E inclusive could not be realised without triggering a resource consent for restricted discretion activity for the breach of the minimum lot size rule, which is currently set at 380 square metres. So on yield, appendix 6 of my statement of evidence dated 3 February 2017 provides an estimation of the yield for the Jackpot zone based on certain assumptions regarding the percentage of open space and the application of the proposed density and lot size rules. So where the density rule was trigger change from activity status to activity status to restricted description higher, that trigger is used as a basis for estimate depth. My previous analysis did not include the requirements proposed in relation to activity via RACS and CHIP, as well as the suggested position tweaking or drying perfect depth. Attached within Appendix 3 is my updated yield table reflecting master flow changes undertaken using the same assumptions for my evidence. Okay, pause again, Frank.
Two, three. Thank you. few questions that came up during the course of the discussion, which I can go to now, perhaps, or if you'd like to have a discussion.
I'm going to say that you can go for 20 minutes because Trent will have the afternoon adjournment. No. Seeing we got to the end of your summary, perfect timing for Mr. Peterson. And we will adjourn until 3:00.